All right, Richard said I'm wasting my time when I say that we've got a lot to talk about. I said, well, I'm going to say it anyway because we've got a lot to talk about. And that's just the way of it. We're in the book of Revelation, and there's a lot of details here that we need to discuss. The 19th chapter, Randy asked if we were going to review a little bit before we get to the 20th. Actually, we're not done with the 19th chapter, but it's necessary for us to review just a little bit to get the context. We've noted in the first half of the 19th chapter, that is verses 1 through 10, that the writer is leading up to the marriage feast between the Lamb and the bride of the Lamb, which I believe is the church, as we discussed in our previous studies. But then beginning in verse 11, there's a second section to chapter 19 that unfortunately there's a chapter division when chapter 20 begins. And the thought from verse 11 going forward continues on into the 20th chapter. And there are several reasons why I believe the chapter division is unfortunate. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But I want to begin our reading in verse 11 of the 19th chapter. And then the focal point of our study is going to be in verses 17 through verse 21. So let's begin reading at Revelation chapter 19, verse 11. And as you know, I'm reading from the 1901 American Standard Translation. Beginning in verse 11 of chapter 19. And I saw the heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat thereon, called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war, and his eyes are a flame of fire, and upon his head are many diadems, and he hath a name written which none knoweth but he himself. And he is arrayed in a garment sprinkled with blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed with fine linen, white and pure. And out of his mouth proceedeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of God the Almighty. And he hath on his garment and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And I saw an angel standing in the sun. And he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come and be gathered together to the great supper of God, that ye may eat of the flesh of kings, and the flesh of captains, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and of them that sit thereon, and the flesh of all men, both free and bond. I want to pause there in the reading, because I think there's a contrast that is certainly introduced in this passage that we need to make note of. The contrast is between the two feasts. First of all, you'll note in the previous half of this chapter, there is a feast that's called a marriage supper of the Lamb. And we talked about that from the standpoint that the church would be presented in its glorified form. The marriage feast will take place. And we studied that from Ephesians 5, verse 26 and so forth. And by way of contrast, you see in verse 17 another supper, but the supper of God that's described in verse 17 is not the same supper that's discussed in verse 9 and 10. The marriage feast of the Lamb to the bride, or to the bridegroom, to Christ, is a very grand occasion. It's the glorification, if you please, of the church in the end, but the great supper of God, beginning in verse 17, as you read the context of that, is entirely different. It is not a glorious event. Rather, it is an event of condemnation. It is an event of judgment and so forth. And that's what we want to note in these verses. We've noted that the great supper of God is not unusual to this kind of language. We're going to look at that again from an Old Testament text in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 38 and 39, to see that the language there is very similar, and we're going to revisit that when we get to the 20th chapter, verses 7 and 8. So we want to be aware of the language that is used. Now, one of the things that we've tried to stress throughout this study is the nature of the language. Apocalyptic language, signs and symbols. And when we read in this chapter, the latter part of it, we're reading of judgment language. And you'll note that the birds are called to eat the flesh of kings and captains and mighty men and horses and them that sit thereon, and the flesh of all men, both free and bond, small and great. So again, we want to note that the language is symbolic. The language is language of judgment, as we have seen in times gone by, and we're going to revisit that as our study progresses. Now, in anticipation of the destruction of the dragon, the beast, the false prophet, and all that follow them, is what we're seeing now in verses 17 and following. Now, if you'll turn back with me, let's review just a little bit to the 14th chapter and look beginning in verse 9. And the scene that is presented in Revelation chapter 14, verse 9, another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a great voice, "If any man worshipeth the beast in his image and receiveth a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he also shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is prepared unmixed in the cup of his anger, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, they that worship the beast in his image, and whoso receiveth the mark of his name." Now, point of emphasis is we want to note that here in this chapter, great judgment is pronounced upon those who worship the beast and those who worship his image, which prompts us to go back to the 13th chapter and note who the beast is and who then the second beast is in the 11th verse, and who those are that worship the beast and receive the mark of his image. If we can identify those, then we know exactly upon whom this judgment is coming. So when we identified the beast in the first part of the 13th chapter, the beast coming up out of the sea, who was that? Randy? That was Rome, yes. And when we identified the second beast in verse 11 that came up out of the earth, what did that represent? The enforcer, yes. And we might call that paganism or those things that would make acceptable emperor worship. But the enforcer will do for our purposes. Now, when we look down at the latter part of the 13th chapter, we read of those who received the mark of the beast on their right hand and upon their forehead. Who were those? Randy?
Those were people that agreed to worship Caesar.
Yes, those who were in agreement with this emperor worship and this way of life to praise and worship the emperor. All three of these, when we talk about the beast, when we talk about paganism or the enforcers, as it were, of emperor worship, and we talk about those who participated in it. You see that in chapter 14 as being the subjects of the wrath of God, the wine of his wrath poured out upon them. Now that's what we're seeing in our text of Revelation chapter 19 in the conclusion of this chapter. And as you look just a little bit further into this, you'll note that the angels come and they call in the vultures. Well, look again, if you will, at the text of verse 17 and following. The birds that fly in mid-heaven, they're called to this great supper that they might eat the flesh of these folks. Now, that, again, is not unusual language. We've seen it, and we'll, on the next chart, see it in Ezekiel chapter 38 and chapter 39. But a more familiar text to you, no doubt, would probably be the text of Matthew chapter 24. So I want you to look at Matthew chapter 24, and I want us to see the language and how it's used there. And I want to try to use this passage of Matthew 24 without necessarily saying that the judgment of Revelation 19 is the same as that judgment of Matthew 24, any more than I would say that the judgment of Revelation 19 is the same as that which was Ezekiel was speaking of in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. Can we do that? Let's look at Matthew chapter 24. In Matthew chapter 24, beginning in verse? There it is, verse 28. Matthew 24, verse 28. We'll begin the thought at verse 27. In that verse it says, "For as the lightning cometh forth from the east and is seen even to the west, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Wheresoever the carcass is, there will be the eagles. There will the eagles be gathered together." Now, we've talked in times gone by, as we've studied Matthew 24, what do the eagles represent? Two things, I think, in this passage.
The New American Standard says vultures.
All right, that works for me. What do they represent?
Rome,
yes. It would indicate the Roman army, because that was the Roman symbol, by the way, of their army. But I want to call your attention to where dead men are, where there's death and decay and corruption. Who usually feeds on that? We say clean up on aisle three when we see the buzzards cleaning up roadkill on the highway, don't we? Well, we understand the principle from what we see on the highway, but suppose that there's war that takes place and there are dead bodies everywhere. What do the vultures do? Clean up on aisle three. They do. They come in and feed on the bodies of the destruction that is caused by war. That was true in Ezekiel chapter 38 and chapter 39. It was true with the fall of Jerusalem that's discussed in Matthew chapter 24. And I would suggest to you that it was true when we see all the pagan religion and the formal worship of the Roman Empire, when we see all that begin to fall and decay. What you see then is the judgment of God, but you see the symbolism of the vultures feeding on the prey that's left, the destruction. Now, having said that, I want us to note the Old Testament text of Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. And we referenced this last time, and I ask you to go back and read these two chapters in their entirety. I don't know if you've taken the opportunity to do that or not, but I would still urge you to do that. For sake of time, we, of course, not going to read these two chapters in their entirety right now, but I do want to note some observations in them. We noted last week from Ezekiel chapter 38, we looked beginning at verse 37 of that chapter. We just kind of skipped a rock down through the conclusion of that chapter, and we read about the destruction that would come upon those who were the enemies of God in that day. You'll see that in verse 19. And the destruction, the judgment of God, came upon those who were the enemies of God in that day, that they shall know that I am Jehovah, verse 23. Now, in chapter 39, again, we're just going to have to skip the rock on the pond to get the point, but if you'll begin reading in verse 17. Yes?
The one you were just saying was chapter 16?
Yes, sir. No, Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 17. Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 17, through the end of the chapter, and then Ezekiel chapter 39, verse 17. So don't get confused on that. It started at the same verse. Yeah, there's a reason why I've got chapter 16 on it. That's from the book of Revelation. Ordinarily, when you see on my chart, sometimes Donna's called this to my attention. Sometimes when I have a passage up there that's just the chapter and the verse, that's what we're currently studying. So that would be from the book of Revelation. Even if I fail to put it up there, that's where you are on that.
Not a typo.
Pardon me?
Not a typo.
No, I can correct that, but that's from the book of Revelation. Okay? Chapter 16, verse 16. I'm going to come back to that because we're going to be discussing the battle of Armageddon in that chapter, Revelation 16, verse 16. But here in Ezekiel chapter 17, I'm sorry. See, I've already messed up. Ezekiel chapter 19. Well, let's try it again. Ezekiel chapter 39, beginning in verse 17, is where I want to read. All right? Ezekiel chapter 39, beginning in verse 17. There it tells us, "And thou, son of man, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, speak unto the birds of every sort, and to every beast of the field, assemble yourselves and come, gather yourselves on every side to my sacrifice that I do sacrifice for you, even a great sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel, that ye may eat flesh and drink blood. Ye shall eat the flesh of the mighty, and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams and lambs and goats and bullocks, all of them fatlings of Bashan. And ye shall eat fat till ye be full, drink blood till ye be drunken of my sacrifice, which I have sacrificed for you. And ye shall be filled at my table with horses and chariots, with mighty men and with all men of war, saith the Lord Jehovah." What's the image that's set forth here by this Old Testament prophet? It'd be great if we took the broader approach and read these two chapters. But you'll note that the enemies of God's people were to be destroyed. And he's inviting the birds of every sort to come and feast on the prey. Well, now, in battle, what would take place? Well, you'd have dead men. What else would you have? You'd have dead horses. You'd have dead animals. But in the context of this, all of this is spoken of as that which God has sacrificed. He's killed them all and delivered his people. and inviting the birds to come and feed on the prey, indicating the extent of God's victory. Now, I say that simply for this point, in order that we might see the language that is used. Now, we know, and let's turn back to the text of Revelation, the 16th chapter, verse 16, and read just a little bit. The context of this 16th chapter, beginning in verse 12, is the pouring out of the sixth bowl of God's wrath. And in verse 13, it says, "And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophets, three unclean spirits, as it were frogs. And they were spirits of demons, working signs, which go forth unto the kings of the whole earth, to gather them together unto the war of the great day of God the Almighty." And then in verse 15 and 16, "Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked, and they see his shame. And they gather them together unto the place which is called in Hebrew Harmageddon." Now, you remember when we were discussing this context of Revelation chapter 16. Remember the map that we had on the board and showed the valley of Megiddo, or the valley of Jezreel. The point being, this is where tremendous battles took place historically, and we talked about the specific battles that are mentioned in Scripture that took place in this vicinity. And one of the things that we commented on is when we talk about what so many are terrified about, the Battle of Armageddon, believing it to be yet something that's future and something that folks have been so bold to try to identify, say, China or Russia, or they go down the list of nations that they think are going to form some kind of confederacy and be involved in this great, tremendous battle against God. And what we want to note is that we're not talking about a physical battle. We're not talking in the book of Revelation using the language of the vultures eating up the flesh. We're not talking about literal horses or eating up the flesh or literal men or these things. We're talking about the extent of God's judgment, like we do in other passages where battles sometimes were literal. But this one is not. This is not a literal war. It's not a literal battle that takes place in a physical geographic location. This is language that is used to talk about the judgment of God against His enemies. Do we see that? Now, the judgment of God against His enemies is not the judgment of God upon nations. Now, we've looked at that in times gone by. We've talked about the judgment of God upon nations. We've talked about the fall of certain cities, like the city of Nineveh, which would indicate the fall of the Assyrian Empire. We've looked at passages that discuss the fall of Babylon and so forth. So we can see the judgment of God upon physical, literal nations and cities in times gone by. But when we bring that language over into the text of the book of Revelation, we're not talking about a physical war. We're talking about a battle between what's good and what's bad, a battle between God and Satan, if you please, and that's introduced to us in chapter 12. Now, does all that sound familiar to you? So let's not then all of a sudden here in the 19th chapter, now we've got a literal battle that's taking place. No, we're not talking about a specific geographic location here. We're not talking about vultures eating horses here any more than we could be talking about other things in this chapter, and the next chapter in particular being symbolic or literal. So we want to note that while we are here at this point in our study. What we want to note is that what has appeared in chapters 1 through 11, what appeared to those who were crying out from under the altar in chapter 6, for example, verses 9 through 11, what appeared to them to be the case?
There would be no justice.
There'd be no justice. No. Satan gets his way, we get killed, and that's the end of it. And then when you begin in chapter 12 going forward, what do you see to be the purpose of all of that? There is vindication.
God has a plan.
God has a plan. Yeah. And we're not talking about God overthrowing empires on the earth. We're talking about in chapter 12 going forward, God's victory over Satan. Good over evil. Don't we see that? Now, to take our thoughts back to the text of Revelation chapter 19, let's read some more and make some applications. Look, if you will, please, beginning at verse 19. It says, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army." Now let's pause there and talk just a little bit about that. I saw the beast. Who is the beast that John saw? Rome. How do we know that? Revelation chapter 13, verse 1 tells us that. Okay, so we know who that is. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies. So we're not talking now about a literal battle that's going to take place, per se. But they fought against him that sat on the horse. Who's that? Who sat on the horse, as we've identified in these preceding verses, beginning at verse 11? Christ is. How do we know that's Christ sitting on the horse?
Faithful and
true. He's the one that's faithful and true. He's the one that's identified as the Word of God. He is the one whose eyes are like flaming fire. And we saw that identified in Revelation chapter 1, beginning in verse 5. And we know that's the Lamb of God, the text tells us in Revelation 1. Now, if we see that described in Revelation chapter 1, the identifying of the Lamb, what's to make us think then that this battle that he's talking about here is Jesus literally coming in some kind of a bodily figure riding upon a white horse? You see, the imagery is what we want to see. What does a white horse generally indicate? Victory. Yeah, victory. And so that's the point that we want to see. He saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies. Well, who constituted their armies? Are we talking about soldiers that have a plume on their head and carry a sword and march row to row? Or who are the armies?
Those who
serve Satan. Yeah. I saw them. And they gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army. Now, who constituted his army? I'm sorry?
Those that serve the Lord.
Those that serve the Lord, yes. Those that serve the Lord. And by the way, you'll note that the source of this army is what John sees in heaven. So we're not looking necessarily at a group of people that are all armed up with helmets and swords and riding on horses. That's not the people. All right? You'll notice further in this context, verse 20, it says, "And I saw the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that sought the signs or wrought the signs in his sight, wherewith he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image." Now, look at that. I saw the beast. He was overcome. And I saw him that was given the authority of the beast. That takes us back to the 13th chapter, verse 11, I believe it is. Yes. The beast that came up out of the earth. The one that had the authority to enforce. And so they're the false prophet. And you'll see that again in the 16th chapter. The false prophet, the 16th chapter, what's the verse? Verse 13. It says, "And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits that, as it were, frogs." So we're identifying the characters in this verse. The beast is Revelation 13, verse 1. The false prophet is Revelation 13, verse 11. Those who were, as we called it, the enforcers, the paganism, the false prophets, as it were. And you'll note them that received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. Who's that? Randy?
You're going fast.
I'm sorry. I'm excited about this.
The false prophet is the enforcers, which is the same as the beast of the land.
Yes.
That's the...
Yes. And that beast was given the authority to put to death those who would not worship Rome. Okay? The enforcer, as we call it. Paganism. Now, I may be not making that real clear, because what I want us to see in that imagery, we call it the enforcer, the second beast. We call it the enforcer. And I guess rightly so, because the idea of the false prophet and paganism, this was teaching that made emperor worship okay. You see, if you can worship the god of the sea, the god of the mountains, if you can worship the gods that we think, the mythological gods and all of that sort of thing, what difference does it make if you add Rome or the Roman emperor to it?
You can worship man-made.
Yeah. That's the point. So you've got the second beast that makes it possible for the first beast to be worshipped. Now, Rome didn't care if you worshipped the mountains or the sea, and just as long as you burn a pinch of incense and commit your loyalty to the Roman emperor once a year. You see, if you give homage to the emperor once a year, then that's okay. Now, the false prophet would tell you that's okay. You can do that. You can still worship the God of the mountains, the God of the sea, all these other things. You can still do that. As long as you do this. Now, where's the Christian in that equation? He can't do that. All right, so these pagan worshipers, enforcers, as we call them, were given the authority to, if you don't worship the beast, if you don't worship Rome or the emperor, we can kill you. Now what are you going to do? We'll kill your family. We'll slay your children. Because Rome says, you've got to worship the emperor. And you can worship all these others. But you see, the idea of paganism and the false prophet makes it possible for you to worship the emperor. But a Christian can't do that.
And that was the problem with the Samaritans.
Yeah.
Samaritans.
Exactly.
They were worshiping God as if he were just another one of God.
Right. Right. And they were doing so willfully. But what we see here is it's being enforced. You must do this. And if you don't, you can die.
So, is that group of enforcers referred to as the false prophet, harkening back to the Old Testament false prophets who weren't really, well, who weren't teaching God's word as it was supposed to be and allowed all this other?
Yeah. I think you've got a parallel, because the false prophets in the Old Testament were doing the same thing. They were doing the same thing. That's exactly right. You can read that in Jeremiah chapter 23. He said, if you've got a word that came from me, then speak it. But the point is, you don't have a word that came from me. And you're deceiving the people. And that's what these were doing. Identical. Very good. Okay. I appreciate you slowing me down, because I've been wanting to say this for 4 weeks at least. And it's an exciting part of the text, and I think a crucial introduction to the 20th chapter. It's just essential that we get this to see what's introducing the 20th chapter.
Verse 20 is pretty exciting by itself.
Well, 19 and 20 go together, and we want to see them that way. And you're right, 20 and 21, this paragraph, is a very good introduction to the 20th chapter. So you've got the sea beast that's going to be destroyed. You've got those that worship the beast, they're going to be destroyed. In verse 20, you've got the beast being taken and with him the false prophets. And, of course, the false prophets we've already read in the 16th chapter, these were those. And the 14th chapter, these were those who appeared to be performing miracles. And one of the things that we've noted that was not uncommon is for those who were false prophets to be able to deceive the people. They had the ability to make the people believe they were performing miracles. Now, when you've got genuine prophets that are performing miracles and raising the dead, what did we find that happened when Moses and Aaron went back, for example, to Pharaoh? And they had credentials to perform miracles. And what were the magicians of Pharaoh doing?
They had a bag of tricks that seemed to simulate something similar.
And what did that produce? We've often said that the purpose of miracles was to validate the teaching of the prophets, that it was true. Now, what about the false prophets? If they could deceive the people, what was the purpose of that? To validate their teaching. Yeah. Now, when you bring that thought to Acts chapter 8 for another illustration, Simon the sorcerer, who gave out that he was some great one, he wanted people to think that he was some kind of a god. What did he do to validate such claims? He had a bag of tricks. Yeah. Now, the genuine prophets, they could perform miracles. These folks were able to deceive the people by their bag of tricks, if you please. Yeah. Now, when you read concerning the Ephesians in Acts chapter 19, the Ephesians, as Paul went into the city of Ephesus, he began to teach them that there's one God. And what did they do with their, we'll call it, bag of tricks, their books of recipes of how to deceive people?
Aren't
They burned them. That was evidence that what we've been doing is wrong, and we know it's wrong. And 50,000 pieces of silver was quite a sum, but we don't want this material in the hands of somebody else to be able to deceive the people. So these recipes for the magical tricks, we burned it, which is evidence of their repentance. They turn from these vain idols. Now, that's the setting that I think we need to see here. There were those who desired to be worshipped, and there were those who made it possible, even demanded, even enforced such false worship. Does that kind of clarify a little bit? All right. Then when you look at verse 20, as it continues, it says, "Wherewith he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image. And they too were cast alive into the lake of fire that burneth with brimstone." Now that's interesting because it takes us back to some passages that we've already studied. In Revelation chapter 14, we talked about the harlot being burned with fire. And who was the harlot? The great harlot. Babylon the Great. Who was that?
Rome,
yeah. Revelation 18, verse 8, same thing. Going to be burned with fire. Now, we've looked at Daniel chapter 7 a lot of times. And I don't want to make more of Daniel chapter 7 than is there. But I don't want to overlook some of the profound things that are stated in Daniel chapter 7. Now, we've in this series of studies, we've gone back to Daniel chapter 2 and brought that thought forward to Daniel chapter 7 especially. When we see in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel telling King Nebuchadnezzar of things that are going to occur as Daniel is explaining the image that he saw, the head of gold, the breast and arms of silver, the belly of brass, and then the legs and feet, iron and clay, as it were. What is Daniel telling Nebuchadnezzar about? What were those to represent? Kingdoms, four empires. And we know where it started because Daniel tells us, "Thou art the head of gold. God's given you the power and dominion." So we know that he's talking about kingdoms, and we know that the succession starts with that of the Babylonian Empire, King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, though Daniel doesn't identify the specific kingdoms, Bible history as well as secular history does. Now, when we look at Bible history, what kingdom followed Nebuchadnezzar? The Medes and the Persians. That's right. When Daniel is telling Nebuchadnezzar that there's going to be a third kingdom, we know that this enters into the period of what we will call the period of silence between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Who was the third king or ruler of that empire? Alexander. And he ruled over what we call the Alexandrian or the Greek empire. Now, when you begin to read in your New Testament, again, Bible history, who is in power? The fourth kingdom. Rome. And as Rome is in power, remember that Daniel had told King Nebuchadnezzar that in the days of the fourth kingdom, God is going to set up one that will never be destroyed. Now, my question to you is, on the context of Daniel chapter 2, is what is Daniel establishing about the kingdoms of men? They're going to fall. That's right. Does that include Nebuchadnezzar? Yeah. Does that include the Medes and the Persians? Well, yeah. And Alexander's kingdom, it fell. And what about the Roman kingdom? Well, it's going to fall too. Yeah, it's going to fall. Now, Daniel doesn't discuss great details about the fall of the Roman kingdom in the second chapter. But as you have your Bible open to the seventh chapter, look with me beginning in verse 23. In verse 23, he said, "Thus he saith, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all the kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom shall 10 kings arise. And another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the former. And he shall put down 3 kings. And he shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and he shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and half a time. Now, we've talked about that expression from Revelation chapter 13 and Revelation, well, we're going to Revelation chapter 19. Now, we've noted that the expression time, times, and half a time, what does that represent? Three and a half, yes, but symbolically, what does that represent? He's saying it's going to happen for 3.5 years. Limited time. That's right. A limited period of time. So Rome would rule, but Rome's rule would not be indefinite. It would be for a limited period of time. And in verse 26, the judgment shall be set, and they shall take away his dominion and consume and to destroy it unto the end. Verse 27, and the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Who's going to win this? God is. The saints are. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Well, that's what we saw in Daniel 2, verse 44, wasn't it? One that shall never be destroyed. He said, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here is the end of the matter. And as for me, Daniel, my thoughts troubled me, and my countenance was changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Now, question, did Daniel understand all the details of the vision that he'd just seen? No, but did he understand that this fourth empire is not going to last? Now, who is the fourth empire? Rome is not going to last. And you'll notice in the seventh chapter, specifically in verse 11, Daniel chapter 7, verse 11, he said, I beheld at that time, because the voice of the great words of which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and its body destroyed, and it was given to be burned with fire. And as for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, and yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. That is a short time. But what happened to their authority? It was taken away. Isn't that simple? And here's a very difficult, complex text. But in reality, it's not that difficult. Daniel is telling King Nebuchadnezzar that kingdoms of men won't last. And even the Roman entity, it's not going to last. It will fall, and that's exactly what John is telling us in Revelation chapter 19, verses 20 and 21. And he said that it will be burned with fire, cast alive into the lake of fire that burneth with fire and brimstone. And then in verse 21, he said, and the rest were killed with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, even the sword which came forth out of his mouth, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. The rest. Well, that would be interesting to try to figure out who that is. There are some different views about who are the rest that's identified in this passage. Well, we know that he's not talking about the beast because he's already identified what's going to happen to them. We know that he's not talking about those who followed the beast because he's already identified what's going to happen with them, the worshipers of Rome and so forth. The rest were killed with the sword of him that sat upon the horse. I would suggest to you that these are those who follow the will of the devil, follow the will of Satan, and their destruction is going to be equally as awful as the beast and those who received his mark. And you'll see the rest, I believe, discussed in this next chapter, in chapter 20, beginning in verse 11 through verse 15, when the final judgment scene is presented. And you'll note in verse 15, in that section, verse 14 beginning, and death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death, even the lake of fire. And if any was not found written in the book of life, he was cast into the lake of fire. Now, I would suggest to you that verses 14 through verse 15 describes anybody, even you. If you determine to follow the will of the devil, that will include you. You'll be cast into the lake of fire. Carol?
Verse 15.
Chapter 20, verses 14 and 15. Did I lead you in the wrong chapter? That don't work. Sorry. Chapter 20, verses 14 and 15. Okay? So I was wanting to identify the rest of verse 21 with chapter 20, verses 14 and 15. Because the end is the same. They'll be cast into the lake of fire. Randy?
The rest would be the lake of fire is the place that you could prepare for the devil and his angels. I can't remember where that where Jesus said that.
Matthew 25.
Matthew
25? Yeah.
I was just looking for it there.
Yeah, Matthew 25. Yeah. It would be after 31, probably about maybe around 40, 41, all in through there.
Yeah. Those on his left, apart from being accursed ones, in the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels.
Yeah.
So that will be the rest.
Yeah. And that takes place at the judgment scene, which is presented in chapter 20, beginning verse 11. Okay? So what we see revealed in these verses that we've just read is what I've called a last-ditch effort, a last-ditch attack. Those who practice evil and those who are tied to that, here's what's going to happen. They're all going to be destroyed. So the victory of Christ is swift, it's complete, it's sure. And what we see concerning emperor worship, what we see concerning Rome, is it's going to be destroyed. It'll fall. The dragon and his allies, who seemed, and I want to comment on this, as you'll note back over in verse, where is it? Chapter 13, verse 4. Chapter 13, verse 4. It says, "And they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? And who is able to war with him?" Now, what I want you to see in this is that the emperor and emperor worship seemed something that was just not conquerable. Not ever going to end. It's going to always be. Now, that was their perception. But when you turn to Revelation chapter 19 and read the conclusion, is that the way it is? Oh, not hardly at all. No, not hardly. No, it's going to fall. And that's the point, of course, that's being established. So what we want to see here is the fate of the two beasts and those who receive the mark of the beast, those who follow them, their fate is going to be destroyed.
One of the things that's taken me a while to grasp, the size and power of the Roman Empire.
Oh, yeah.
There had never been an empire like that.
No.
I mean, we talked about the four kingdoms, and of course, Assyria was before that. There have been kingdoms throughout history, going back to Genesis. Nimrod had a kingdom. So kingdoms, but the Roman Empire was huge. They were a kingdom made up of kingdoms.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And real. It was a brutal, all-powerful, state-run. You did what you were told, or you were killed.
Basically, yeah. Yeah.
So, knowing that, and of course, Carol and I watched a couple of documentaries on the Roman Empire, it just sort of boggled our minds and helped us to understand more about what we're doing here. The Christians that were living in the Roman Empire, they needed this book.
Oh, big time.
They must have thought this is never going to end. We had a perspective of time.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
But they were under the thumb of the Roman Empire, and like you said, when you're threatened with death of you or your family, if you don't worship the emperor.
Right.
Many people caved.
They
caved in and said, okay, I'll burn the bench.
Yeah. And you see why the Jews were so terrified of Rome. But they were tolerated. But now you've got Christians. One of the rules of the Roman Empire, as it were, they, at least at some points, they tolerated existing religions. But if you introduce something new, off with your head, so to speak. And so the Jews were tolerated, but they didn't like that. They wanted it to go back like it was during the days of David and Solomon. We talked about that in other studies. But yes, to see the vastness of this empire, the power that it had, all the way around the Mediterranean Sea, you see why that John relates that when Rome would fall, that the merchants would weep. The mariners would weep. Certain cities that were popular as far as their trade was concerned, like Tyre, would be terrible. Because Rome controlled the commerce of the known world. All the way around the Mediterranean Sea. And I don't know that we wrap our minds around how big that was. You know, when you consider the Mediterranean Sea, it was huge. And then when you take the land masses that were approximately, average I'm told, about 200 miles inland from the Mediterranean Sea, you're encompassing all the trade of the ancient world. So Rome was filthy rich, and anybody associated it was filthy rich. And then when Rome began to come apart, those who were associated with it were scared to death.
But it was very encouraging for Christians in the first century to read this and say, as big and powerful as Rome is, it's coming down.
It won't last forever.
Because the God who created us is much more powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
Than any kingdom.
Yeah, and that's the point. Now, when we get into the 20th chapter, I just regret that we don't have the time to just go right on into the 20th and talk about the all the way into verse 6 of the 20th chapter. But we'll try to do that next time, and I'll try not to spend as much time on the 19th.
I know it.
That's hard for me. I get excited, as you can tell, but it's hard. All right, we'll start there next time.